Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. This podcast is also sponsored by DocketWise, an all-in-one immigration forms and case management solution trusted by thousands of immigration lawyers across the U.S. I really like DocketWise. It makes immigration applications easy by allowing the clients to provide information through simple online questionnaires that are shareable by text or email and available in multiple languages. Not only that, DocketWise provides a comprehensive group of case management features, including invoicing and calendaring, secure messaging, task management, and a lot more. You can learn all about DocketWise and receive a 10% discount on your subscription by heading to docketwise.com/immigration-review, so they know we sent you. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. In immigration litigation news, a district court in Massachusetts held this week that a Salvadoran man who was deported from the United States, despite a First Circuit stay of his removal, can move forward with his suit against the federal government for injuries that he later suffered in a Central American prison. A Federal Tort Claims Act lawsuit on the issue survived the federal government's motion to dismiss. No small thing. As to this week's appellate decisions, I got six cases, starting off with some fab from the BIA, a bunch of non-citizen bad in the middle, and some fab asylum to conclude from the 11th Circuit. I don't know if Gen Z people say fab, but I'm gonna do it. Fight me. First up is matter of Duarte Gonzalez, published by the BIA. What a case we have from the BIA this week. This case is about unlawful presence. Mr. Duarte Gonzalez is from a foreign country. The BIA does not say. He came to the U.S. on a temporary visa in 2000, and he overstayed his authorized time by little over 1 year. And then he eventually departed in August 2001. He was readmitted temporarily into the U.S. that same month on a non-immigrant visa, authorized again temporarily for a 30-day stay. This time, Mr. Duarte Gonzalez didn't leave at all. He's been in the U.S. ever since. That makes him removable under INA Section 237A1B for overstaying his visa. But now he has a U.S. citizen son over the age of 21 years old. He's been here 22 years after all. And that son petitioned for him. Approved immediate relative I-130 in hand, Mr. Duarte Gonzalez sought to adjust to LPR status in immigration court under INA Section 245A. Now he's got the inspection and admission, and he's not inadmissible for any criminal reasons. However, the immigration judge believed him inadmissible under INA Section 212A9BIII. That statute makes non-citizens inadmissible for 10 years, absent a waiver, where the non-citizen has accrued more than 1 year unlawful presence in the U.S. and then departed the U.S. It's for this reason, for example, that we file I-601A waivers for non-citizens in the U.S. without authorization and who were never inspected or admitted, and who need to consular process to get immigrant visas. They'll trigger this 10-year unlawful presence bar when they depart the United States to consular process. Hence the need for a waiver beforehand. Not at issue here. Just as good a time as any to mention the I-601A process. Mr. Duarte Gonzalez triggered the 10-year bar when he departed the U.S. in 2001 after being here for over 1 year without lawful presence. But now it's been over 10 years. Indeed, it's been over 20 years. No matter, said the IJ, the 10 years must be spent outside the U.S. for him not to be inadmissible, so Mr. Duarte Gonzalez remains inadmissible, said the IJ. And to be fair, that's generally been considered the law in many quarters for quite some time. But not anymore. Quote, the plain language of Section 212A9BIII of the INA does not require the respondent to remain outside the United States during the 10-year period of inadmissibility, end quote. The reason, said the BIA, is that under the plain text of the statute, quote, the period of ineligibility runs from the date of departure from the United States and does not require a non-citizen to remain outside the United States for the entire 10-year period of inadmissibility, end quote. It's not like INA Section 212A9C, which does expressly require that a non-citizen wait outside the United States for 10 years. Indeed, the fact that the very section next to subsection B, subsection C, expressly requires 10 years abroad leads to a, quote, negative inference, end quote, that subsection B does not so require. Subsection C, by the way, is the much more serious inadmissibility subsection applicable, for example, if a non-citizen unlawfully enters the U.S. twice. Not the case here, because recall Mr. Duarte Gonzalez never entered the United States unlawfully, much less twice. He just kept overstaying. All of this means that in the case of Mr. Duarte Gonzalez, he is not in fact inadmissible, meaning that he is eligible to adjust LPR status and that he should become a green card holder if an IJ believes that he warrants it as a matter of discretion. Case remanded. Congratulations, Jamie M. Diaz, for Mr. Duarte Gonzalez. A few more thoughts. As my arch-nemesis immigration attorney and consulate USCIS whiz Kevin C. Gregg noted on Facebook, USCIS has actually been following this policy for quite some time now. But it's always wonderful to have it in a precedential decision binding upon IJs. And while this is a great holding for non-citizens, to me it also seems applicable under narrow circumstances. For this decision to apply, and essentially barring an exception that I'm not thinking of, a non-citizen would need to have been admitted into the U.S. temporarily by mistake that second time, without fraud. Like Mr. Duarte Gonzalez, the non-citizen would need to have been inadmissible under INA Section 212A9BIII, but admitted into the U.S. nonetheless, thereby permitting the 10 years to run in the U.S. This decision doesn't appear to help those who enter the U.S. without authorization after triggering the 10-year bar, because those non-citizens are likely inadmissible under INA Section 212A9C. Do procedurally lawful but substantively flawed inspections and admissions count? The matter of Kietan issue? I don't see why not. Can't wait for that decision. For what it's worth, the BIA does recognize in a footnote that USCIS has been doing this for a bit, noting that while USCIS policy memorandum is of course not binding on IJs or the BIA, it is, quote, persuasive, end quote. So keep citing to those USCIS policy memorandums where helpful, of course. They're persuasive. And that is matter of Duarte Gonzalez. Next is Wren et al. V. USCIS, published by the Fourth Circuit on February 14, 2023. Don't look now, but we have an employment immigration case on the pod, an EB1C case. Let's do it. Mr. Wren is from China. He's lived in the U.S. for 7 years, entering the U.S. on a one-year L1A visa, and then receiving 3 2-year extensions of that status, quote, the maximum allowed, end quote. He got all that because he's president of Elizer International, Inc. Elizer is a Virginia company, and it's a wholly owned subsidiary of a China-based company that produces handmade glass products. Elizer markets that to U.S. markets. As we'll see, the corporate structure is very important to Mr. Wren's immigration prospects. Having maxed out his temporary L1A visas and having lived here for a long time, Mr. Wren sought permanent EB1C immigrant status. Makes sense because the analysis for both a temporary L1A visa and a permanent EB1C status is pretty much the same. Therefore, and like it had done in the past, Elizer filed a petition for Mr. Wren's benefit with USCIS. For the EB-1C, Eliza filed a Form I-140 petition with USCIS, which, if approved, would permit Mr. Wren to adjust to LPR status before USCIS, just like if he had an approved family-based I-130 petition, for example. As an aside, and there are a bit of asides this week, unlike family-based immediate relative adjustment of status, Mr. Wren couldn't have adjusted if he had been barred under INA Section 245C, which covers things like unlawful status and unlawful work. Both can bar employment-based adjustment, unlike immediate relative family member adjustment. Not at issue here, though, because Mr. Wren always held and worked with valid L1A non-immigrant status while in the United States. L1A and EB-1C status is given to multinational managers and executives. That's why that corporate structure is so important. You need to first have either a multinational company or a separate foreign and U.S. company in a parent-subsidiary relationship. Satisfied here. Next, though, Mr. N needed to show, for EB-1C purposes, that he worked in a qualifying managerial or executive capacity in the foreign company for the requisite amount of time, and that he'd be working in a managerial or executive capacity going forward in the U.S. company. A bit of a legal fiction, right, because he has been working in the U.S. company for 7 years, but he still needed to show that in the past, before all that, he had worked in a qualifying position for the China-based company. USCIS ultimately denied the I-140 petition. It did not believe that Mr. Wren had worked as a manager or executive in China, or that he had been working or was going to work as a manager or executive in America. So Mr. Wren sued under the Administrative Procedures Act. After all, USCIS had held differently on the L1A petitions. The district court ultimately agreed with USCIS on its EB-1C denial. Up to the Fourth Circuit it went. Again, no dispute that Eliza has the foreign domestic structure required of EB-1C. But was Mr. Wren actually a manager or executive both in China previously and in the United States now? Despite approving the L1A petition many times on this exact issue, USCIS changed its mind at the permanent visa stage, and the Fourth Circuit affirmed the district court's affirmance. The INA and the regulations have long definitions of managers and executives that I will not bore you with by repeating here. But you know, managers manage and supervise, and executives direct management. To summarize that very, very briefly. More germane to this decision to the Fourth Circuit, to meet this showing, the sponsoring employer, quote, must submit a detailed list of job-related tasks that the punitive beneficiary has performed or will perform. General or vague descriptions are insufficient, end quote. Emphasis by the court. And those details must show that the beneficiary, here Mr. Wren, will be, quote, primarily, end quote, performing managerial or executive tasks. Merely, quote, some will not do, end quote. In this case, the Fourth Circuit believed the submissions vague and unspecific about what Mr. Wren was actually doing when employed at China by the parent company. The Fourth Circuit didn't know what he was actually doing, much less whether it was sufficiently managerial. The court believed Eliza's submission, quote, filled with fluffy descriptions devoid of any real substance. It largely reads more like a collection of one-liners useful for resume drafting than a meaningful description of the duties that Mr. Wren actually performed, end quote. Eek. But also, quite the indictment of resumes. USCIS wanted to know what Mr. Wren was doing day-to-day. And that day-to-day, it was of managerial or executive nature. The Fourth Circuit saw no error in that requirement and agreed that Eliza had failed to show it. So, while they don't happen often, here's another decision seeming to raise the burden on EB-1C and L1A petitions. Get your corporate documents in a row and maybe even hire a business plan company or another immigration-focused business company to assist. And I guess, be very specific in what you say are the day-to-day duties of the beneficiary. Here's something else of difficulty. Scary footnote, the Fourth Circuit essentially says that if Mr. N had been challenging USCIS's denial to grant adjustment of status to EB-1C rather than merely his preliminary I-140 petition, the Fourth Circuit would have lacked jurisdiction to review the issue. A scary holding in its own right, and I don't think it's crazy for a court to one day find that I-140 or I-130 adjudication is so wound up in adjustment of status that even that is barred from review in district court a la Patel. A horrifying thought for another day. And actually more on that in 15 seconds. And that is Wren et al. v. USCIS. I hope you enjoyed that 15 seconds. This is Britkavi v. Mayorkas, published by the Seventh Circuit on February 17th, 2023. It's a brutal decision on district court jurisdiction and Patel. To be honest, the analysis is quite complicated, but really it isn't so important. I kind of just wanted to mention this case so that it appears with all the other cases on the podcast's homepage. Are you aware of that page on the KKTP website, by the way? Links in the show notes. I use it as a research guide multiple times a week myself. Check it out! So, let's add this case to the list. In this decision, the Seventh Circuit has realized the biggest fears of federal court litigators post-Patel. According to the court, INA Section 242A2BI and Patel strip district courts of jurisdiction over Administrative Procedure Act and presumably any other challenges to USCIS denials of adjustment of status applications, no matter the issue in dispute. My God. Justice Barrett's dicta in Patel put into effect. To the extent that INA Section 242A2D, the Savings Clause, permits any review whatsoever of adjustment of status denials, that review must occur on petition for review in circuit court. But of course, litigators cannot sue directly in circuit court, and that's not how petitions for review work anyway. Meaning that if USCIS denies an adjustment of status application and does not put a non-citizen into removal proceedings, or if, like here, the non-citizen adjustment applicant is deemed an arriving alien, the non-citizen has absolutely no way to challenge USCIS's denial of adjustment of status. District courts, at least those sitting in the Seventh Circuit, cannot adjudicate the issue. It didn't matter here that, like in Patel itself, Mr. Britkavi was not challenging the denial of adjustment of status as a matter of discretion, but rather the preliminary, unwaivable inadmissibility finding that he had made a false claim to U.S. citizenship. Didn't matter to the Seventh Circuit. It's an adjustment of status adjudication, and Patel took an exceptionally broad view of the INA's jurisdiction-stripping scope. Well beyond, by the way, that being argued by the Solicitor General in Patel. In a telling quote, the Seventh Circuit repeated the Patel majority's quote that, quote, policy concerns cannot trump the best interpretation of the statutory text, end quote. It's a holding and rationale that the Supreme Court found untenable in St. Cyr many years ago, and which Justice Gorsuch and the Patel dissent believed, quote, turns an agency once accountable to the rule of law into an authority unto itself. Perhaps some would welcome a world like that, but it is hardly the world Congress ordained, end quote. Rejecting Mr. Britkavi's alternative arguments based on the presumption of reviewability, legislative intent, and the fact that this decision may bar review of adjustment of status applications filed by T and U visa victims, the Seventh Circuit ordered that Mr. Britkavi's case must be dismissed. A devastating holding, if a bit expected following Patel, and a must-read for Seventh Circuit immigration litigators. And I fear it is only the first of such circuit decisions. And that is Britkavi v. Mayorkas. Moving on to two from the Ninth. First, Lopez v. Garland, published by the Ninth Circuit on February 16th, 2023. This decision is about appellate procedure. Mr. Lopez is from Mexico and entered the United States without inspection in 2001 and was placed in removal proceedings in 2015 through service of a deficient notice to appear. In removal proceedings, he sought withholding of removal and Convention Against Torture protection. His asylum application was, of course, untimely, and it appears they didn't have a good argument to excuse the one-year deadline. After the Supreme Court issued Pereira, Mr. Lopez moved the immigration judge to terminate proceedings based on the deficient NTA. At the time, though, such motions were rarely being granted, based largely on a rationale later held to be incorrect, based on notices of hearing. But here, the IJ did grant the motion. How about that? But then, quite paradoxically, to be honest, the immigration judge went on to adjudicate withholding and CAT protection in the alternative and denied it in the alternative, notwithstanding the IJ having terminated proceedings just before. DHS appealed the termination, but Mr. Lopez did not appeal anything. Instead, he responded to DHS's appeal before the BIA, arguing that the BIA should affirm the termination decision and, alternatively, that the BIA should overturn the IJ on withholding and CAT protection. The BIA overturned the IJ on termination, sustaining DHS's appeal. In overturning the IJ on termination, the BIA relied on its precedent at the time, which is wrong today. The BIA believed everything cool because Mr. Lopez had received a notice of hearing. Ms. Chavez and later precedent says otherwise. But at the time, it is what the BIA had held via precedential decisions. So the BIA overturns termination. And, because Mr. Lopez hadn't filed an appeal himself, the BIA declined to address withholding and CAT protection, and ordered Mr. Lopez removed. Mr. Lopez petitioned for review to the Ninth Circuit, and waived all of his challenges to the deficient NTA and termination. I suspect he waived it because at this point his 2018 jurisdictional arguments would have failed in the Ninth and elsewhere, and it appears that he never brought claims processing rule arguments. I don't know, just a guess. So the only thing before the Ninth Circuit, then, is the IJ and the BIA's denial of withholding and removal and CAT protection. But not really. Because again, Mr. Lopez never appealed it to the BIA. Mr. Lopez argued that under the regulations, he didn't need to cross-appeal to the BIA to challenge the IJ's denial of withholding and CAT protection, where DHS had already filed an appeal. But that's not how it works in federal court, and said the Ninth Circuit, it's not how it works when appealing to the BIA, either. Quote, the cross-appeal rule is an unwritten but long-standing rule under which an appellate court may not alter a judgment to benefit a non-appealing party, end quote. Now true, quote, a party need not cross-appeal if all it wishes to do is present alternative arguments for affirming the judgment, end quote. But that's not what Mr. Lopez was trying to do. He was trying to get the BIA to overturn the IJ without filing an appeal himself. Can't do that, said the Ninth Circuit. According to the court, the BIA could change the rules and it could not require cross-appeals. But it never has, so the de facto cross-appeal rule governs. Mr. Lopez therefore lost his case. Bit of a double-edged sword of a decision. Permit me to explain. Obviously, a rule requiring non-citizens to appeal to get review of issues where DHS has already appealed other issues is a bit of a harsh rule, particularly for pro se non-citizens. But like here, with withholding and CAT protection in particular, appeals get complicated. By definition, when that relief or protection is granted, a non-citizen is first ordered removed, and often has an asylum claim or other forms of relief that can lead to LPR status denied. A non-citizen may want to challenge the initial removal decision or the denial of that other relief. But sometimes, a non-citizen may not want to file an appeal for fear that if they do, A, DHS might cross-appeal to challenge the hard-won withholding or CAT grant, or even if DHS doesn't cross-appeal too, the non-citizen might fear that the BIA might decide to deny the non-citizen's appeal and then to vacate the IJ's withholding of removal or CAT protection grant. These are real fears when deciding whether to appeal in such cases. Well, the Ninth Circuit just held that the BIA can't do the latter thing. It cannot vacate a withholding of removal or CAT protection grant if DHS has not appealed it. As to the former, the fear that DHS might cross-appeal, well, might I suggest filing a notice of appeal on the very last day, if you've got the guts. And that is Lopez v. Garland. Next is USA v. Alvarez, published by the Ninth Circuit on February 16, 2023. This case is about aggravated felony crimes of violence and attempts. It arises, however, in the illegal reentry criminal context. It's a heady week. Mr. Alvarez entered the United States unlawfully after being removed previously, based on a prior finding that his prior conviction for felonious assault on a peace officer under Section 2903.13a of the Ohio Revised Code was a crime of violence, and thus an aggravated felony under 8 U.S.C. Section 1001a43f. He's now being charged criminally for having entered the United States illegally after being removed for an aggravated felony. He's arguing that his Ohio conviction is not an aggravated felony. If he's right, and if it's not, then it's possible that Mr. Alvarez's conviction here would be fundamentally unfair, and that his criminal proceedings for illegal reentry should be dismissed. The argument goes he shouldn't have been removed in the first place, so it shouldn't form a basis for his criminal illegal reentry conviction now. A district court disagreed with him. A district court held that felonious assault of a peace officer in Ohio is an aggravated felony crime of violence. Here, the Ninth Circuit agreed in a very complicated decision. Now, just from the get-go, a non-citizen can possibly avoid criminal prosecution for illegal reentry and, quote, can show that his due process rights were violated by defects in his deportation proceedings if he shows that his underlying state conviction was not, in fact, an aggravated felony, end quote. So Mr. Alvarez is making the right arguments to avoid a criminal conviction for illegal reentry. The thing is, though, that the Ninth Circuit believes that the Ohio crime is an aggravated felony. The criminal statute holds that, quote, no person shall knowingly cause or attempt to cause physical harm to another or to another's unborn, end quote. An aggravated felony crime of violence, in turn, using the definition at 18 U.S.C. Section 16a, requires that the state court crime have an element, the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force. Now, it seems like knowingly causing or attempting to cause physical harm would by definition require the use or attempted use of physical force. Au contraire, the categorical approach can do interesting things. Mr. Alvarez's very smart federal public defenders argued that the mental state required of attempted assault in Ohio, knowledge, is less than the mental state required of generic federal attempt. A specific intent to commit the crime is required under federal attempt law. Therefore, so the argument goes, the Ohio statute is broader than the federal definition and cannot categorically qualify as a crime of violence, because Ohio criminalizes more attempts than does the federal government. That's how the categorical approach works. To the Ninth Circuit, though, Mr. Alvarez is basing his argument on, quote, a critical error, end quote. The Ninth Circuit believes that Mr. Alvarez needs to compare his Ohio crime to the crime of violence definition generally, not to a federal generic attempt definition. We're about to jump into the exceptionally complicated categorical approach attempt issue, adjudicated mostly with Washington state crimes and last decided by the Ninth Circuit in United States v. Doar. As a bit of history, after some favorable case law on this issue, namely United States v. Valdivia Flores, the Ninth Circuit kind of shut the door in Doar. And I swear to God, that pun was not initially intended when I wrote it. Doar and all of these pretty much are sentence enhancement cases. But as those analyses affect immigration, the Ninth Circuit held in Doar that, quote, when the prior offense is alleged to have as an element the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against the person of another, end quote, which is what the immigration crime of violence definition also requires, quote, we only ask whether the prior offense does in fact have one of those elements, end quote. That is, the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force. Restated, the Ohio statute doesn't need to match the federal generic definition of use, threatened use, and attempted use to be a crime of violence. It just needs to match the, quote, crime of violence definition as a whole, end quote. So then to the court, even if Ohio attempt is overbroad vis-a-vis federal attempt, the crime is still a crime of violence because I guess Ohio use of force or threatened use of force matches the federal definition of those things by requiring a mental state of knowledge. That's how I read the analysis anyway in this decision and in these very complicated other decisions. If we're talking overbroad mens rea, as Mr. Alvarez is arguing we should, the Ninth Circuit explained that we need to compare the Ohio requirement of knowledge to the crime of violence mens rea requirement generally, not to attempt specifically. And if we're doing that, the Supreme Court recently explained in Bourdain that knowledge satisfies the general crime of violence mens rea requirement. Under Bourdain, a mental state above recklessness is sufficient to make a crime of violence. The analysis does not require a parsing out of attempt versus use or threatened use. The mens rea analysis compares the mens rea required of the conviction to the mens rea required of the removable offense, and knowledge cuts it for crimes of violence. It's all really complicated, not least of which because this is all like a decades-long attempt, again, I swear, no pun intended, by federal public defenders in the Ninth Circuit to make defendant-friendly law in the Ninth. And just reading the case law analysis employed by the Ninth Circuit here, it's complicated and it's a long-running dispute. With Doar and this decision, it seems like the Ninth Circuit is beginning to shut it all down. Mr. Alvarez had one more argument. The Ohio offense doesn't require violent force, as required by the crime of violence definition. Summarizing recent complicated Supreme Court precedent on that issue, the Ninth Circuit boiled the dispute down to, quote, whether Ohio's definition of physical harm requires force capable of causing physical pain or injury, end quote. If it does, it satisfies the Supreme Court's decision in Johnson and Stoeckling on the issue of physical force. This decision is not for crimmigration newbies, I'm sad to say. The Ninth Circuit held that the Ohio crime so requires, a holding that aligns and indeed follows a holding from the Sixth Circuit on this very statute. And the Sixth Circuit is the circuit with jurisdiction over Ohio. Ohio felonious assault on a peace officer doesn't permit conviction by mere de minimis contact. If it did, it wouldn't be a crime of violence. But, although the statute itself permits conviction, quote, regardless of its gravity or duration, end quote, of harm, seems de minimis to me. The analysis has become a bit different after the Supreme Court's decision in Castleman and Stoeckling. Under those decisions, the focus is on force, quote, capable of causing physical pain or injury, end quote. And that can be almost any force, right? Almost anything can be capable of causing physical pain or injury, even if it doesn't. Mr. Alvarez even found a case where the defendants were convicted in Ohio for throwing water balloons. But to the Ninth Circuit, that case was a bit more complicated than Mr. Alvarez made it seem. Quote, throwing water balloons at cyclists and others from several stories high is capable of causing physical pain or injury, end quote. At least under the construct implemented by Justice Thomas's 2019 opinion in Stoeckling. Mr. Alvarez therefore lost his case in a head spinner. And that is USA v. Alvarez. Wrapping up with Sarah v. U.S. Attorney General out of the 11th Circuit on February 15th, 2023. This is a long case about credibility, asylum, and kidney stones. Why not? And it's favorable to the non-citizen. Soak it in, 11th Circuit practitioners. There are only two or three of these from the 11th Circuit every year. Mr. Sarah is from Cuba and approached the southern border in 2019 seeking asylum. Had he done so during the 60 years or so prior, he'd likely have been paroled into the U.S. and then, after 1 year, like his Cuban and only Cuban brethren, would have been permitted to become a lawful permanent resident. But not anymore. No longer are Cubans simply paroled into the United States. Now, like all other non-citizens, they must litigate their asylum claims unless they have another basis to immigrate to the U.S. Interesting issue currently pending at the BIA, however, is whether mere release of Cubans, and all other non-citizens for that matter, by immigration authorities, constitutes a parole, such that at least in the case of Cubans, they will once again be on a path to adjusting to LPR status under the Cuban Adjustment Act. But I digress. I'm sure I'll be talking about that issue again later this year. So anyway, back to Cuban asylum. Mr. Sarah claims that he was imprisoned for a year after he stopped appearing for his mandatory military service in Cuba at around 18 years old. He claims he was labeled a, quote, counter-revolutionary, end quote, and that years after his initial incarceration, he was imprisoned three more times for his, quote, failure to participate in mandatory political activities and because Regla, his home municipality, is known for counter-revolutionary activity, end quote. Persecution through prosecution. Remember it. Mr. Serra claims to have been verbally and physically assaulted by police in prison, quote, police hit him with batons, broke his tooth on a bar, and kicked him in the ribs. As a result of his beating, Mr. Serra passed a kidney stone. The report from Mr. Serra's Credible Fear interview indicates that he passed the kidney stone on the day the police kicked him, end quote. He fled Cuba with his son and his son's mother shortly after his release, arriving at the southern border in 2019. Not before spending a year in Bolivia and 7 months in Mexico, though. No mention of whether there are firm resettlement or transit bar issues in this case. Let's go with no. He had his merits hearing before an IJ, pro se, from detention, and at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, via televideo. An IJ deemed Mr. Serra not credible for reasons that the 11th will soon reject and that I will soon discuss. The BIA affirmed. The 11th Circuit remanded, despite its very deferential standard of review, for such issues. To the 11th, quote, the evidence compels a reasonable fact finder to find otherwise, end quote, even with all reasonable inferences favoring the IJ and the BIA. See, although IJs have broad discretion to make adverse credibility findings based on inconsistencies in the 11th Circuit, IJs can't do so in a vacuum simply by identifying inconsistencies. Instead, IJs must consider any inconsistency in light of the record in totality, consider the context of the statements, and must not, quote, excessively focus on insignificant testimonial inconsistencies, end quote. A standard violated here. First, the IJ believed Mr. Serra inconsistent in his initial testimony to border officials that he had passed a kidney stone on the day he was beaten by police officers. Because Mr. Serra later testified in court that the kidney stone exited his body 7 days later. But Mr. Serra's alleged first statement comes from a Credible Fear interview transcript, which, as we all know, is merely a summary of the interview, and in this case at least is, quote, rife with errors, end quote. Perhaps more importantly, the 11th Circuit saw no important discrepancy. Mr. Serra's testimony about how it all went down, the police batons, the beating, etc., was consistent between his first interview transcript thing and his individual hearing testimony. And isn't that more important than when and where he passed a kidney stone? DHS and sometimes IJs love to attack credibility based on dates and other specifics from years in the past. But to the 11th Circuit, and at least in this case, quote, the timing of the release of the stone from Mr. Serra's body is immaterial, given the consistent description of his abuse at the hands of the Cuban police, end quote. The 11th Circuit wants IJs to focus on the bigger picture, the context, and the totality of circumstances. Not just whether there is some inconsistency present. Not only that, but to the 11th, and like its prior non-citizen-friendly precedent, Mr. Serra's, quote, explanation of the kidney stone incident is more elaborate than the information he initially provided because he was asked additional questions about it, end quote. Makes sense, then, why he'd add more details in his multi-hour immigration court hearing. Finally, wrapping up its kidney stone analysis, it seems like there were interpretation issues at both the Credible Fear interview and merits hearing stage. Even the interpreter needed clarification in court. The adverse credibility finding cannot stand based simply on Mr. Serra's urinary tract. That then left the other inconsistency relied upon by the BIA, the number of countries that Mr. Serra traveled through before arriving in the U.S. Quote, in his ruling, the IJ only noted that Mr. Serra listed 10 countries on his I-589 application, but then testified to 11 or 12 countries that he had passed through at the hearing, end quote. Pro se, remember. But to the 11th Circuit, the record clearly showed that Mr. Serra was estimating that he had passed through like 11 or 12 countries. Much like a kidney stone passing through his... Alright, I'll stop. Quote, given that the standard the IJ used to measure Mr. Serra's credibility on this point was one of approximation, the substantial evidence standard compels us to reverse the IJ's adverse credibility determination, end quote. There's a quote for you. Respondents are allowed to approximate things rather than provide absolute certain testimony. And when they do, it might be inappropriate for IJs to then rely on that approximation to make an adverse credibility finding. The phrases, as I recall and I believe, may be your client's best friends. Pretty irrelevant anyway. Mr. Serra's quote estimate of about 11 or 12 compared to a list of countries provided on his I-589 application almost 2 months before his merits hearing is simply immaterial to his credibility, and a reasonable fact finder would not conclude otherwise. End quote. Case remanded for further analysis. Because according to the 11th Circuit, and not for nothing, quote, for decades, the authoritarian regime in Cuba has utilized its police force to intimidate and physically assault political dissidents and peaceful demonstrators throughout the island, end quote. Sounds like the opening sentence of every Cuban asylum case in the 11th Circuit to me. A long one, but a good one. Here's some more before we go. Interesting fact in country condition evidence from a footnote. Mr. Serra described his hometown of Regla, quote, as the most worm municipality in Cuba. The term worm, or gusano, was used by Fidel Castro to describe counter-revolutionaries, but is now embraced by the opposition to the authoritarian regime in Cuba, end quote. Good to know. And good to remember, because with asylum, labels and names by authorities are very important to establish a protected ground and the views of the persecutors and society as a whole. Also, if looking to attack adverse credibility in the 11th Circuit, look to Cuevaco v. U.S. Attorney General and Tang v. U.S. Attorney General, both from 2009, like the 11th Circuit did here. Those are two of the necessary adverse credibility cases for non-citizens' counsels to rely upon, in one podcaster's humble opinion. Add this one to the list. And that is Serra v. U.S. Attorney General. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate for 5 credit hours, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all. And follow the show on Instagram and Facebook, at Immigration Review, and send us a tweet, at ImReview. That's I-M-M Review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.